Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Lauren Frances Adams. Lauren is a painter and mixed media installation artist, incorporating traditional designs and decoration with contemporary Americana. Her wallpapers depict class struggle and labor movements. She also works as a full-time painting faculty member at the Maryland Institute College of Art in Baltimore and was one of our first Clark Hulings Fund Business Accelerator grant recipients in 2013. Welcome to the show, Lauren. We know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about your background and what you do for a living?
Hi, thanks for having me. Let's see. I grew up on a pig farm in Eastern North Carolina, and my family is from a long line of farmers. And despite that, I, from a young age, wanted to be an artist and was encouraged into that by my family. Now I live in Baltimore, Maryland. I teach painting, like you said, at the Maryland Institute College of Art. I would say generally my work involves the subject of labor and protest and ornament and pattern. My work is often in gouache on paper as well as installation-based work. And currently this year I'm on sabbatical from teaching and I'm at a residency in Brazil right now, the Sakatar Foundation residency. So if you hear dogs barking in the background, please excuse me.
Well, you know, we like dogs on this show, so we're okay with the animal attendees. I don't know if I want to hear the pig farm in the background, but I imagine you only pay, you know, occasional visits to it these days. You use several different mediums, painting, drawing, printmaking, digital manipulation, you do installation works. What is it significant for you to have such a wide range?
Oh, right. Well, partially, I think it's probably my attention span. You know, I'm excited about a lot of different mediums. I get really interested in various methods of working, particularly because painting has such a long history and it encompasses so many different materials and methods. You know, I'm pretty voracious in terms of wanting to reach out and kind of every kind of painting method there is. You know, I've tried a lot of different kinds and always want to try more. And I just don't have that sense of limitation that I think maybe might shut down some good ideas sometimes. And maybe that's more in line with conceptual art making where I'm really trying to use the materials and methods that fit whatever concept I'm exploring the best.
Well, you must learn something from crossing media that way. You know, have there been any useful lessons or any insights you've gotten from working across such a diverse set of media?
I feel really lucky that I've been making art for a long time. You know, I'm in my mid-30s now, and I studied art in undergrad, where I went to UNC Chapel Hill and got my BFA, and I went to grad school at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And, I feel very lucky that I had that training, but I also see my artwork and my practice as a long-term pursuit. Like, I really hope I'm making lots and lots of art, even more than I'm making now when I'm in my 60s and 70s. I think that would be a gift. And I think, I think if you're curious about the world, which, you know, the best artists are, then you're curious about materials and media and the history of them. And I think painting is just a really fundamental human activity alongside drawing. And I only think it's really important, maybe in the academic sense, to talk about how those disciplines distinguish themselves and to kind of draw a line sand. But when we're looking at the history of art making and the variety of ways in which many contemporary artists work, that's to me when those lines in the sand are totally irrelevant. So I'm really interested in ideas. But yeah, again, I mean, back to like why painting is always home base, what I always come back to is the fluidity of it. I really like working with, water-based mediums like gouache, where you really kind of have a loss of control. And so I am a little less interested in the kinds of things like printmaking, where you don't get to kind of not know what it looks like until the very end. I mean, with like digital printmaking, for instance, which I've done a little bit more of recently, you get kind of locked into the work. And I think there's some possibilities with that. But I also find with my painting practice that the kind of chaos and loss of control is one of the most exciting aspects of it.
Well, for some of your installations, you've created entire rooms all the way down to the wallpaper. Why do you do that?
Well, I think the biggest most general answer I can give you is because I've had a desire from a pretty young age as an artist to pursue this idea of art into life. Some of my favorite artists that have really inspired me, everybody from people like Robert Rauschenberg to the Soviet, the Russian revolutionary artists like Rodchenko and Stepanova, and, all kinds of art that maybe we don't even call art with a capital A or even call art at all. Maybe it's more like craft and things like this, that it's this idea that art can permeate all aspects of life. And I'm really influenced by the domestic sphere in terms of content. I'm constantly finding inspiration in the world around me. And so part of my work where I create these sort of total installations, the way Ilya Kabakov talks about the capital T, capital I, total installation, comes out of that desire to kind of envelop the viewer, to make a kind of experience where you can't really contain it all in one view. I mean, I think that's what's really amazing about painting, is that you do kind of have to solve the problem within the boundaries of the picture plane. But I find it also a really unique challenge to think about how that boundary can be broken and expanded and turned into kind of an immersive experience.
So your work involves wallpaper, but have you ever thought about mass producing your wallpaper?
I get that question a lot. I again, if I'm going to follow the line that like art into life, and especially thinking about some of my heroes like Rodchenko and Stepanova, the Soviet artists from the early 20th century that were designing clothing for the worker, clothing for sport. They were designing porcelain and things like this that was meant to reflect the new reality of the political moment at that time. That's just one archival example. It's not the only one. I think there's this idea that artists designing things for the mass market can be a realistic and really exciting thing. But I have not yet had the opportunity to work with a company that I think really gets what I want to do. But I don't think that closed doors to the possibility that it might happen in the future. I mean, I also think part of the problem is as an artist thinking about what the terms of production are. I in my studio control the means of production in a pretty tight way in terms of generating the content and also executing it. I have occasionally worked with other people to see through my ideas, and even working with machines sometimes, like a CNC mill, like where computer and numerically controlled, where I'm kind of making the drawing and the machine actually creates the tooled item. So I've been interested in that for a long time, but I think there's always the question of ethics, making sure that whatever is mass produced is ethically produced and sourced, and that the output is something that meets a level or a standard that would be worth the investigation and worth putting out there.
I like that you said that you control the means of production. I think Karl Marx would approve. So that brings me to our final question about your art before we sort of shift into art and business, which is so why the focus on labor and class?
Well, it goes back to, a lot about how I grew up in a farming family from a long line of farmers. There was an emphasis on understanding how work and play were divided. And, both my mother and father, my father was a very hardworking man. My mom was a hardworking woman. And having those models in the context of rural farm life has left a really big imprint on me in terms of understanding how labor functions on a larger scale, both, in the United States and in other places. I'm really grateful this year that I get to travel to some places, long sabbatical and stay in residencies in places like the Netherlands and now here in Brazil. And I'm continually fascinated with how labor functions, both in terms of creating economies and economies, how they can be visualized, how labor is visualized and represented. It's actually often the people that work the hardest who are the least in control of what happens with the value of their work. And I think a lot of my interest in labor connects back to the ideas of the myth-making of American idealism, American sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, the melting pot theory, all these things that have contributed to an ideology about the supremacy of the American identity. Part of what I think my project is as an artist is to kind of pick that apart and figure out what that means in terms of the system we live in, which is the capitalist system, and the larger global systems that we also fit into, even though we may not think of ourselves as being part of that on an everyday basis.
Now, you've traveled for residencies and shows, as you've mentioned, across Brazil, the Netherlands, France, England, Serbia, Sweden, across the U.S. Has your travel influenced the subject matter of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you asked that because it sort of follows up on this thread that I was picking at right there. Yeah, I do. I mean, first of all, it's really part of personal pleasure. I just really enjoy travel, and I feel really grateful that as an artist, it's part of how I can kind of build, what I do. And I recognize that if I didn't like it, I could easily be an artist that doesn't do that at all. But I feel very fortunate that I'm able to build those connections and have invitations that do take me to these places. And I actively seek them out. And I think part of it is just wanderlust, a kind of like tension between homesickness and wanderlust, of like a feeling of you have to go away so that you can come home. And a part of going away is helping give me perspective on the things that I think are of interest to me about the American condition. I really am grateful to have those opportunities because I do think it informs the kind of research I do. And, particularly with the history of the United States, that's the whole reason why I'm in Brazil right now at this residency, was to get some perspective on the transatlantic triangular slave trade between Europe, Africa, and the Americas. And I think often when we talk about the history of labor and race relations and politics and class in the United States, we don't necessarily understand how that might be in another place, particularly in South America. So I don't know that I even can say, after being in Brazil for 2 weeks, what yet I have found or will find, but I know it will add up to something really profound for me. So and it really does mean being somewhere. I think it really matters to be on site, talking to people, connecting with the community, seeing on site archival resources like museums, having conversations, those sorts of things.
So there must be also some impact of this kind of traveling around, doing residencies and shows, on your business. And I'm curious about that. Maybe you can elaborate even on some of the specifics. Like, what are the challenges you face and how do you solve them? More importantly, how do you solve them? For instance, with international shipping, how do you plan and prepare your art for shipping?
Well, shipping's the thing I hate the most about any of anything to do with art. I mean, like I said, I'm not in a position where I've had a lot of assistance or anything like that. And often the work I'm making, especially if it's a strange shape, I really want to be in control of doing that myself. So everything from like the actual packing is something that I normally do myself. Shipping, it can be really expensive if you want it done safely. I at this point am working with institutions that work with me on those things because I think even the art world has changed a lot in the past few years, and the kind of art world where artists are paying for everything, paying for all the shipping, basically carrying the burden of placing their work into situations where the public and the institution gets to enjoy the fruits of that work is not sustainable. So, you know, I feel right now that there's a bigger shift going on in the art world and a bigger set of conditions that artists are understanding. And I also think younger artists are understanding it much differently maybe than artists of older generations. And I'm talking about artists who are younger than even me in terms of like the kind of economy we live in and how you deal with certain things like, okay, there's a show in Germany, but the gallery's not paying for it to be shipped. What do I do? Right. And everybody has their own set of conditions. You know, maybe if you really want to be in that show in Germany, maybe you are going to pay to have your work shipped there and shipped back. And I think those are all really personal decisions that each artist has to make based on what they see as the value of the opportunity.
What about insurance? Who pays for that?
Oh, that's a really good question. Do you mean, I'm assuming you mean insurance in terms of when the work is not only being shipped, but also on display. So in that case, you know, any place that's professional is going to have insurance. I think it's always a good idea to ask. I mean, I'm still surprised sometimes when there are some galleries or institutions who indicate that they don't have that, and I'm always a little surprised. You know, obviously, I never ship work without making sure it has insurance, and anytime the institution or myself is paying for it, if the institution's paying for it, I always double-check with them when they're shipping something back that they're going to get insurance, because, you know, maybe it's the institution is made up of multiple people, but maybe the person who ships the work is new and hasn't ever had to think about that before, right? Or maybe in the last job they had, they didn't do that. So I don't know. I take a very hands-on approach. It's because what I'm doing is, you know, I'm the principal here. I'm like the one kind of running my studio. So I'm always trying to double check about that stuff.
So what about the financial planning? Obviously, you have to plan ahead financially for travel and shows. What goes into that for you? What do you find challenging?
That's such a nuanced question because, I mean, probably the most difficult thing I have to do is say no to either participating in something outright because, you know, of an unrealistic expectation from a curator or some other, you know, institution or whatever that wants me to do some big project that costs a lot of money, but then doesn't actually want to give any of that money to help make it happen. Or, you know, having to scale back a project because I want to take part in it, but because they're not offering any financial restitution, there's no way that I could afford to do it. You know, I've been in this thing before where I did a project that was seen by a lot of people at an art fair in Chicago a few years ago, and I have had multiple requests over the years to remake that work, but that work is actually all hand-painted protest signs from Occupy Wall Street and Tea Party protests, and I hand-paint that into an existing wallpaper that I buy usually off a place like eBay, and it's a vintage reproduction. It's a beautiful wallpaper, so I'm just kind of intervening in it. I'm kind of making these little painted interventions, but to recreate a 20 by 20 foot installation of that wallpaper, you know, it took me weeks leading up to the exhibition where I was working like full time on just the painting of the wallpaper, not to mention any other component that went into that project. And I mean, at this point, I almost, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but it's sort of like you wonder if some people are even thinking about the labor that the artist puts into it. Like, because ultimately the wallpaper is not that expensive, but, you know, one time gets expensive when you're thinking about this kind of laborious work. And that is the kind of work I like to do. I think if I were a different kind of artist, maybe one that worked more gesturally or, you know, even worked with less conceptually rigorous. I'm not saying that artists who work with like minimalism are conceptually rigorous, but usually when I'm arriving at an artwork or a painting in particular, there's many hours of research and reading that have sort of accumulated and, you know, been compounded into that work. And it does get a little frustrating, and it's one of the sort of problems I'm facing more and more that I do have to say no when I either don't have the funds to, like, let's say, print something ship a big work or even ship myself, you know, because that's another thing about site-specific installation, that I've had a lot of curators and that want to work with me on doing something that's specific to a site. But the flip side of that from the financial perspective is that that work can be really exciting to make, but if they're asking the artists to not only put their labor into that, but also their time, let's say fly somewhere, spend a few days on site, of course, preparing for all that work for weeks before you even get there, and then have the show up, and then the work only really kind of exists in that space because it's, you know, specific to the context in which you've been invited. It can be really a challenge to say, well, is this really, like, it's, especially if they're, you know, not offering any financial compensation for being on site, flying there, your labor, a stipend, something like that, plus the materials, and then the work only is sort of fitting within that context, that can be really problematic for the artist, right? Because you end up having work that, while beautifully situated in that moment, may not have a very long shelf life outside of that moment.
What about visas and travel papers? Is that a challenge, or do you breeze right through that for all of these different countries?
No, nothing's, especially, you know, with leading up to Brazil, I mean, the Olympics are kind of making everything a little different. So if you come to Brazil in June or July or even August, I think you don't need a visa. But, you know, I haven't had too much trouble with that. I'm a pretty good internet sleuth, which comes from a lot of my kind of inquiries into my art practice. So I've gotten a lot better at, like, figuring out how to do things in terms of the rigmarole of the bureaucracy. You know, in Brazil's defense, the only reason they have a visa process is because after 9/11, the United States required them to, Brazilian citizens to have visas to visit the U.S., so it's a reciprocal visa process. But, yeah, I mean, you know, those are things you have to think about, you know, as you were asking about the financial stuff. I was really shocked that a visa costs $160 to come to Brazil, so that, you know, that's something I have to make sure that I take note of for any time I'm planning that kind of thing in the future. And that's only because I was able to go in person and actually deliver my paperwork to the consulate in D.C. myself and actually take, you know, it was almost a whole day to get the paperwork and then, of course, go on foot. If you're doing all this, let's say you lived in Pennsylvania, in Western Pennsylvania, and you needed to go to New York to your consulate, you'd probably have to take off even more time, or you do it online and then it costs hundreds of dollars to pay someone else to do it. So, yeah, you have to do your homework. And but this is the thing I hate the most, other than shipping, about being an artist, is like the sort of tediousness that doesn't feel very rewarding at all.
Well, that makes me want to bring up sort of a broader question of, you know, this isn't a 9-to-5 job. So obviously, with all the travel involved, et cetera, no one's reimbursing you a travel allowance for every hour you're on the plane. So how do you balance residencies and travel versus studio time and the need to market your work?
Oh, this is the question I've struggled with quite a bit this year, and I didn't anticipate this one. You know, when I have been planning my sabbatical for a few years, and, you know, after teaching for 8 years full time at various institutions, it's really, you know, I can't even really describe how wonderful it is to have this opportunity to, you know, not have teaching be part of my schedule, and instead be able to have the freedom to travel. And I've been very lucky that I do have these opportunities to, that I've applied for to come to various residencies. But I severely underestimated when I was daydreaming about all the research and the work I could do in these intensive periods of residency. I severely underestimated how much that kind of preparation for travel and the legwork for things like the paperwork and the, you know, hunting down the plane tickets. Like, you know, I'll be very transparent and say, you know, in terms of funding my sabbatical, MICA does not pay me my normal full salary because I'm taking a whole year. So I've had to be very thrifty with how I go about buying plane tickets. And of course, I've been looking into residencies and accepting places to do my work that also support back with things like reimbursed airfare, or, you know, they're paying for like the studio and the food and, you know, the place to sleep and all this stuff. But I severely underestimated how much time it would take just to like maintain a thriftiness while doing this year of travel. So I definitely think that when doing this kind of work, I don't know that you could really tell anyone that. I think you have to learn it for yourself. But I'm sort of shocked when I think about how other artists are able to travel the world and do installations and projects at a variety of places around the globe and maintain their kind of maintain the threads and the train of thought in the studio. And, you know, one of my friends who's way more mature with his work than I am reminded me that many of those artists also have assistants who are answering the emails and doing the work back in the studio. And I don't have that. I just have myself. And I think I just have tried to maintain a discipline and also make sure that when I'm somewhere that I actually do give myself some time to play and enjoy the space and not always be thinking about the next thing. Because that is the point of the whole thing. But I think that discipline is really necessary. It's not easy for me. It's not been easy for me.
You're both a professional artist and a professor of painting. So are they equally important to you, or do you teach because you can't support yourself 100% with your art?
Well, I've heard plenty of times, or read, I should say, plenty of times that cynical view that one may be only teaching because they can't support themselves with their work. I actually like to think about it in sort of like the opposite point of view, which is that the teaching that I do, which, you know, being part of an academic system and support network with my great colleagues and my students who are always doing really cool stuff in the studio and are always inspiring me in the best of ways and challenging me to teaching me new things. And having that support network, not only of things like libraries and tools and, you know, great people to talk to, a kind of network, that actually allows me a little bit of freedom, a financial freedom to make the kind of work I want to make because I'm not bound to the other system, which is, you know, the gallery system, where an artist may have gallery representation and may have a regular schedule of exhibitions. But of course, one always has to be thinking about if the work is selling, what's selling, do I need to make more of that work that was selling? Is this new work going to sell? I mean, you know, I have a lot of friends that have gallery reputation, and there's always that, from the people I've heard from, I'm sure there are exceptions to the rule, that there's a separate set of conditions one has to be concerned about when one's represented by a gallery. And the reality is that very, very few artists are supported full time with the production of their work. And I don't know. I don't often think in terms of like, oh, my teaching job, the relationship it has to financially supporting me to make my work, when I'm sort of forced to, usually in the interview context, to talk about that. I think it's, to me, I get so much more of a benefit from being a teacher in terms of like my sort of artistic spiritual life and what I get out of it in terms of like what I get taught, you know, by my students, by my colleagues, by the school. It's a pretty healthy balance for me. I do always want more time in the studio, but I say that about lots of things. I mean, sometimes I'm grumbling about social time and play because I know I need to have a project finished, or I'd rather be working on something that's really exciting for me at that moment. I don't begrudge my day job for that. You know, I actually think of it as really fluid, and for me it works out pretty well in terms of the kind of balance between the two.
So has being a professor influenced the art you create in the sense that it makes you perhaps more self-conscious or self-critical?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I mean, Yes, absolutely. Well, first of all, you have really curious young people who are always, you know, in the best of ways, asking the question why. And I've always been a questioner in that same way. I've always been very curious and sort of asking why. Why is it that way? And, you know, that's one thing that a young college student, they don't have to be young, just has to be someone who's young in art, you know, who's there to learn at like the foundation or at the sort of college level. Is asking those questions, why? Why do we do this? Why don't we do that? Like, you know, what are those conventions and what do they mean? And, you know, I think that's really, really cool. And there's some really radical stuff that can happen in that atmosphere. And, yeah, I definitely think that influences the way I work and sort of the things I'm thinking about. And, yeah.
So let's shift a little bit to grant sort of related questions. And again, you know, you're a 2013 grant winner at the Clark Hulings Fund's Accelerator Grant. So I want to know, you know, most artists can't support themselves from their art without writing. And you're an old hand at grant writing and finding additional support opportunities like our grant. And you've written for us about ways to do this successfully. So can you talk a little bit about why you consider this aspect of the business success?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think part of what I sort of hinted at in terms of like the freedom to make the kind of work I want to make outside of the gallery system. I mean, you know, who knows, one day maybe there's a gallery that will be a fit that wants to represent my work in that way. In the meantime, grants have in the past provided me, if not stable, at least really appreciative forms of support in terms of being able to, you know, elevate the work. Like with the Hulings Fund, I was able to frame dozens of paintings for an exhibition that ended up, you know, that work has now traveled quite a bit around the United States on exhibition. And, you know, that's usually not the kind of thing that I can justify always coming out of my own pocket. But if I have the support of the grant, that can kind of help elevate the work in a pinch. Like I said, the grants aren't always a stable source of that kind of support. But the motto or the sort of way that I approach it is that, you know, if you have a little bit of time, you know, most people I know pick a day of the week or a few hours in the week or a few hours a month or, you know, maybe quarterly or something like this where you devote to that kind of administrative paperwork that if you're applying for things, the odds are eventually that you will be successful. And, you know, in this past year, I applied to a lot of residencies and grants and other things that I have not gotten. I would say even half the things that I've put myself out there for, but I know that I can't even begin to talk about succeeding in them until I've at least put my hat in the ring. And, you know, some of the things that I've done that have helped me is work with other artists to polish my materials, help them with their writing, understand my own approach to it. And that feeds into the rest of my practice, right? Like, because I know if I'm, you know, be it preparing my preparing for a lecture for my students or for a presentation I'm doing as a visiting artist or writing a grant, I already know that that is helpful in terms of like requiring me to put my thoughts down in a format outside of my head, you know, outside of my sketchbook and my sort of note-taking that I do, and into a kind of more formal, like, fixed language. And that can be really, for me, that's really productive. That's a really good kind of perspective to have because it actually helps me think through other things that I may not be addressing in the work or help me make connections that I haven't made before. So, yeah, it's interesting that, like, obviously it's nice when you get an award that gives you financial support, but there's this other kind of thing that can happen in terms of having a grant writing kind of dedication over the years.
So, you know, the Clark Hulings Fund contributed to, you know, two projects of yours specifically in 2014, one at the Claremont Farm and the other at Katz and Arts Center. I'm curious about how those relate to your business. How are you able to leverage the grant to do even more with those projects would have other?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, like I said, the example of having the framed work what has allowed me then to turn around, and as I've gotten requests to show that work more and more, allowed me to immediately have the work available for shipping, to send it off, you know, to participate in exhibitions, and have a consistency with the work too, you know, working with a professional framer that has the same stock that's going to have a consistency to the work, so that it, so that that becomes something that's not fussy or, you know, noticeable to my viewer, so that it, you know, allows the work to be seen in its best context. It happened, so I think, if I'm remembering correctly, that when I got the Hewlings Fund grant, I had just been in conversation with the professors at American University to do a site-specific installation for their building that would stay up for a whole year. And the cool thing about that was that I was able to then, I think this is how it worked, I then went to the Hewlings Fund and said, okay, so this other thing popped up, you know, it's a site-specific project, they don't, their budget is nice, but I need a little bit more to make it work, can I take some of this funding and sort of shift it over here, and it all worked out really well to do that. And, you know, especially with the site-specific work, especially with like a academic institution, you know, it's always nice to have a little bit of extra in case, you know, your calculations are wrong and you need to print a little bit more than you thought you need to print, or you need to, you know, stay on site for two more days and you didn't anticipate that to begin with.
So would you say that the money that went for framing, that essentially it went to give you credibility and allow you to achieve sort of more recognition, or was that, what's the cumulative value? If you were to sum it up very simply.
Yeah, I think credibility is a, I think that's a good word in terms of, you know, if it wasn't framing, it would be the cost of, you know, expensive canvas and stretcher bars. And then, you know, if you have something heavier like that, it's going to cost more to ship, you know. I think there's a kind of finish in terms, or polish in terms of, like, you know, the work, just like I said before, like if it's done well, like if a painting is stretched properly, the idea is that you won't notice that it's stretched properly, and that won't be a concern for your audience, and therefore they won't be distracted by some material, you know, interruption, and they'll be more focused on what you're trying to present to them as an artist, unless, of course, like some kind of weird stretched canvas is like the point of the work or something, you know, which it can be. Yeah, so I think, you know, yeah, I think I really do think it's about that, that sort of sense of polish and clarity. And, you know, with that specific series of work that you're referencing when you ask that question, I mean, that work, it's very intimate, you know, it's dozens of small paintings on paper that are like mixed media gouache acrylic and spray paint, and they are very, they're a mix of abstraction and figuration, and they have text, sort of handwritten painted text, and I've been told that work would fit best in a book, like, or would fit really well in a book format, because watching viewers look at the work, people get really invested in looking at the images from a distance and then getting up close and reading it and kind of like poring over it the way one would inspect, you know, a crack in the wall. And I think, like, in terms of credibility, like you said, with that kind of intimate work, like, it has to be on point. It has to be really, really polished. And I think absolutely, like, when I was able to use that grant to tie all the work together and make it a cohesive body of work through the framing, which my framer was awesome and really, really understood what I was trying to do with the work and floated these works really beautifully and helped me sort of like think that through, you know, I just would have been able to make that investment without that funding.
So one more grant related question, and then we'll sort of wind down the show with a fun question or two. So, you know, how do you mm-hmm. decide which grants to apply for? Do you have a quota per week or per month, or what do you do exactly?
Well, fits and starts. I mean, let me be clear. I'm not an expert or a powerhouse or anything. Like, you know, I applied for a grant a few months ago that I had been told for years I should apply for. I had been thinking for years I would apply for. And, you know, for whatever reason, just because it's the kind of grant where it really is a lot of paperwork. I mean, there's some that are just really easy, like, oh, submit 10 images and your artist statement. And, you know, you'll hear from us in a couple months. And then some are, you know, more detailed where they want tax forms and statements from, you know, a year or two prior, or, you know, maybe they need letters of recommendation or this or that, you know, or they need a specific project proposal that hasn't even been written yet. And, you know, it's not easy. Like, I am the last one to say that administrative tasks like this are a fun and necessary part of being an artist. I think, though, if you do want something like that, you have to actually put in the time and, like, you know, devote yourself to doing it. And in terms of, like, my perspective on it, I guess I could go for, like, a year and not apply for anything like that. And then maybe because I'm in kind of, like, a mode where it just seems, okay, this is working. Like, I've got this thing. I got the balls in the air. Like, the time is right. Let's do a couple of these. And sometimes it's just deadline-driven. There's the panic of the deadline, you know. And so you just have to get it done. And, yeah, so I wouldn't even say I'm a great model in that term. But I do want to make it clear that, like, there's no way you can win if you don't play. And so the things that I've applied for that I've been successful in wouldn't have worked out if I just sat by the sidelines and watched the deadline go by. And there's been plenty of things I've applied for and over again and have never achieved success with it. Maybe one day, you know. Yeah, so that's sort of, like, to me, it's not really a mystery. Like, I just got to put myself out there, and maybe it's the right time, maybe it's not. And you don't know what that committee's thinking. You don't know, you know, who was on the jury. You don't know who else they pick. Maybe it wasn't the right fit for the mission for the institution at that point. And I just try not to take things personally.
So if, as we wind down the show, I'll ask you a couple of fun questions. If you could go back and do one thing differently when you started, knowing what you know now, what would that be?
When I started life or started being...
Well, no, we don't want to go back to the womb, but maybe just back to when you began your career.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't even know when I began, like, how to say when one began their career. Okay, but that's not what you're asking. no regrets. No regrets.
Well, so if you could look forward and have one superpower or magical power that you currently don't have to do something that you'd like to do with your career, what would that be?
I think I just wish I had more time. You know, I feel like I have all these ideas, and even with, you know, the gift of not having classes for these two semesters, I still don't feel like I have enough time to see through all the ideas I want to see through.
Lauren Frances Adams, the artist who can turn back time. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund. For more information on Lauren Frances Adams, visit lfadams.com. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and listen to our iTunes and Stitcher program. Thanks for listening, and thank you, Lauren. It's been really great having you.
Thank you.